And I've been talking about this as if everybody kind of has a bit of an understanding that these are the kinds of things that you encounter all the time. It just seems like everybody that you talk to believes these theories, and they just kind of assume that that must be something that you believe. I'll tell you how widespread it is. I was doing a little bit of surfing on the internet and ran across the little video clip that I'd like to share with you. Can everybody see Pat Robertson?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Let me play this, and I think you'll be able to hear it. If you can't hear anything, let me know, and I'll just have to dispense with that. But this is an effort to share a little bit with you.
You say, well, Putin's out of his mind. Yes, maybe so. But at the same time, he's being compelled by God. He went into the Ukraine, but that wasn't his goal. His goal was to move against Israel ultimately. And God is getting ready to do something amazing, and that will be fulfilled. And what Putin is doing by moving as he is to set up Ukraine as a staging ground for one of the armies, and then across is Erdogan at Turkey, and you've got between them that little Dardanelles area, and it's going to happen. So I just say that is what's coming up. Is Putin crazy? Is he mad? Well, perhaps. But God says, I'm going to put hooks in your jaws, and I'm going to draw you into this battle, whether you like it or not. And he's being compelled, after the move into the Ukraine, he's being compelled to move again to get a land bridge and then across the Dardanelles with Turkey, and watch what's going to happen next. You read your Bible, because it's coming to pass.
Okay. Well, that's kind of the general feeling of most people. And as you watch something like that, you see him do some things that people who aren't good Bible students buy into. Remember how he talked about God putting the hooks in their lip and drawing them? That's not a reference to anything that's happening today. It's something that is a biblical concept, but it's not a reference to anything that's happening today. That's the way he presents it. And people who don't know any better just get sucked into that kind of thinking, that kind of thought process. And it's really sad. It almost makes me angry that people do that. They take little bits and snatches out of the Bible and they repeat them. And people that aren't good Bible students let them get away with that. It's like they put the Bible together like it was a jigsaw puzzle. Well, we've tried not to do that.
Dean?
Yeah.
I was just reading today because I'm in Ezekiel now. So all of those things are happening, and they tell where it's going to happen. It's going to be at Gog. He's going to be destroyed. And of course, Babylon is taking over. And that's what he's saying is just totally out of it. It has nothing to do with today.
That's
already been done.
That's right.
Anyway,
that's the problem. It's already been done. But if somebody isn't a good Bible student and hasn't read their Bible very carefully, they buy into this kind of thing.
That's very true.
And yeah, go ahead.
Just one thing that that it was the losers of the battle that had the fish hooks put through their lips and as they were taken away as slaves, not the king of the country that was invading.
You're absolutely right. But people buy into that kind of state. That's the best protection against being sucked into these theories is having good Bible knowledge, knowing what the Bible says. But most people, sad to say, have never read the Bible cover to cover. I hate to admit it, but when I was a young man, I hadn't read the entirety of the Bible. I've read big parts of it, but I've never sat down and read the entirety of the Bible. And you just can't do that. So let's talk about some of these theories that get bantied about, and they come from little bits and pieces of biblical information that are then woven together, but they're woven together in a way that makes no sense. The first one is a theory that was, generally speaking, popular during the Second Great Awakening, that restoration period that we're talking about right now. Alexander Campbell started two journals. The first publication that he had was called The Christian Baptist. And he had a falling out with the Baptists and came to the conclusion that he didn't want to have anything to do with the Baptists in his journal. And so he stopped that publication and he started a second one that was called The Millennial Harbinger. And the whole purpose of that journal that Alexander Campbell put together was to encourage people to be united. And if Christians could just be united, he was convinced that was the final piece that had to be in place for the kingdom to be set up. That's why he called it the Millennial Harbinger. He was telling about the millennium that could come if people were united. And he felt like this is what it would take to make Jesus' second coming a possibility. Now, he doesn't develop the notion to the extent that some other people did, but this is what most of the restorationists believed, something called post-millennialism. Then there's another theory called amillennialism, and this comes from the combination of millennialism and the old Greek root a, which means no, or there's not going to be one. And most people that I talk to accuse me of being an amillennialist. I'm not. I firmly believe that we are in the millennium right now. That 1,000-year reign, that's the millennium. We are in that 1,000-year reign right now. And we've talked about that before, how Jesus came to do two things, to die on the cross to forgive sins and to die on the cross so that he could establish his kingdom. But when I talk about the millennium, I'm talking about something that exists. I'm talking about something that exists in what most people call the age of the church. And when I talk about the age of the church, I'm talking about something that extends from Pentecost, when the church was begun, until the final judgment, when Jesus comes back the second time. I also believe that this millennial reign is a spiritual kingdom. It's a spiritual reign over a spiritual kingdom. That's why Jesus, when he was talking to the Roman authorities, said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight. But my kingdom is not of this world." And if you think that there's some sense in which his servants are going to have to fight in order to establish his kingdom, then you've missed what he told them. I believe that we're in the millennium right now. I believe that Jesus is reigning with God. I'm not an amillennialist. I'm not an amillennialist at all. I believe that the millennium exists. The thousand-year reign of Jesus is right now. I have a lot of people that come to the door and they say, "Aren't you looking forward to Jesus reigning and Jesus being the king?" And I say, "Yeah, I really enjoy the fact that he does that." And they pick their jaw up off the ground, and then we generally have a kind of short, unproductive discussion. But I think this kingdom exists now. Don't ever give that up. So any questions about those first two theories? Okay. Then there is what I call a historic premillennialism. The church, or the church age, is the phase of Jesus' kingdom rule while he's ruling from heaven. And in that we agree. But then they argue that church age is not the thousand-year reign, that's not the millennium. What they suggest is that at the end of the church age, Jesus is going to come back to earth, and he's going to set up his throne, David's throne, in the city of Jerusalem, and he will establish a thousand-year reign in the city of Jerusalem. And all of the Old Testament prophecies that deal with Israel being restored to their land, they say are talking about Israel's restoration during the thousand-year reign. And that should be 1,000, not 1.000. So they think that all of those prophecies that were given to Israel when they were in Babylonian captivity, that they would be brought back to their land at the end of 70 years, they think all of those prophecies are still waiting to be fulfilled, and they're going to be fulfilled during the thousand-year reign of Jesus on the earth. That's essentially where Pat Robertson is. He picks up all these little bits and snatches of Old Testament history, and he says, "See, that hasn't happened yet." And people aren't savvy enough to understand and say, yeah, it's already happened. And so he gets away with it. And then there's what's called dispensational millennialism. And that's not my term for it. That's a term that I'm not sure exactly where it came from, but that's what most people refer to it as. This is a part of the thinking of a very famous writer, John Walvoord. He was the president of Dallas Theological Seminary, and he wrote a book called The Millennial Kingdom. And that book became the kind of the key to understanding millennialism as he thought about it, dispensational millennialism. Hal Lindsey wrote The Late Great Planet Earth. Same philosophy. You see it in the Left Behind series that Tim LaHaye has done, and that one shows on TV. You've probably seen evidence of people buying into that when you see a bumper sticker on a car that says, in case of rapture, this car will be unmanned. And there are all those kinds of memes that are floating around out there. That's dispensational millennialism. And it differs from historic premillennialism in two pretty significant ways. The first one is that the dispensationalists talk about a gap in the interpretation of biblical prophecy. The Old Testament promises concerning the blessings of national Israel, they say, would have been fulfilled when Jesus came the first time, but the Jews rejected him, put him on the cross, and so he had to go back to heaven, and he gave us the church as a stopgap to get us to the time when he would eventually come back and he would do what he intended to do the first time. And when I say this is something that is so widespread and is very dangerous, part of the reason is that this is built around the notion that Jesus was trying to establish his kingdom without the cross. That the cross prevented the kingdom from being established. And I can't find anything worse than a philosophy that denies the value of the cross. But that's what the dispensationalist millennial theory does. So they talk about the church age. That's where we're living. And then they talk about the kingdom age. But they see those two things as spanning the distance between Pentecost and the final judgment.
Dean?
Yes.
It seems to me that they have an awfully pitifully weak God that can be defeated by a bunch of grumpy Jews who didn't want to accept him as king. I mean, he's all powerful. I mean, there's no way that God can be defeated because somebody didn't want his plan to be fulfilled. He would have fulfilled it and raised up new things from rocks.
So how do you really feel about it, Carol? But you're right. You're right. They have a pitiful view of God, whose purpose can be thwarted by the Jews, or even the Jews plus the Romans, the most impressive power on the earth in those days. And that just doesn't make much sense to me. Other thoughts? Okay. The second thing that is in historic that's in dispensational premillennialism, that's not really discussed in historic premillennialism, is this concept of the rapture. So let's see if we can't try to understand what the rapture is all about. Now, I lifted this diagram from some material that was done by some folks at Embry Hills in Atlanta. And I can't draw for beans. So I lifted this diagram from them. And as you can see, can you see my cursor? Does anybody see my cursor, or is it just me that can see that?
No, we can't.
Oh, you can see it?
No.
No.
Can't see it. Okay. Can't see it. That's okay. Over there on the left, where you see the cross, that's the beginning of the time period that this talks about. Importantly, they discount everything that happened before the cross. So just remember that. I think it was Jimmy was saying they forget that all those promises were fulfilled before the cross. For them, time starts at the cross. And you have the church age, which is what we got because the Jews rejected the kingdom. They rejected the king. And just by way of illustration, and we didn't talk about the 70 weeks in Daniel, but this is between week 6 and week 7. And between weeks 69 and 70 in Daniel's prophecy in Daniel 9. We just didn't talk about that. It's not real clear to me. I'm just not comfortable with an explanation of that I have put together that makes a coherent picture in my mind. So we'll not talk about the bottom line down here, Daniel's 70 week period. But at the end of the church age, the end of the age that we're living in right now, they say Jesus is going to come back and he's going to take all of the Christians, those that died already and those that are still alive, he's going to take them back to heaven. And they're going to be with him in paradise. The rest of the earth, everybody that's left, goes through what they call a 7-year tribulation period. And they say that tribulation period is what's described in Revelation, the 4th through the 19th chapters. And then they say Jesus comes back his second coming. It's really not his second, it's his third. But they say when Jesus comes in the rapture, he doesn't come all the way to the earth. He just comes part of the way, picks up the Christians and takes them back with him. So Jesus' second coming, he brings all those saints with him at the end of the 7-year tribulation. And he sets up his kingdom on the earth. And the saints get to rule over the wicked. Jesus gets to rule over the wicked. And that's the 1,000-year reign. That's what they call the millennium. That's the kingdom period as opposed to the church period. And then they say at the end of all of that comes the great white throne judgment, where everybody now gets to stand before God. And we have heaven and hell that are the issue of that great throne judgment. Any questions about what's in this diagram? I think I can answer most of them, but you may very well answer a question that I'll have to say I don't know.
Dean?
Yeah.
What's the point of Jesus and all of the saints coming down for the 100-year reign to rule over all the wicked? I mean, if they're wicked, they're not going to be converted. So is it just, I get to rule over you? I mean, it doesn't make much sense to me. And who would want to leave heaven and come back here to earth?
That's my question too, Dean.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Of course, when they come, in the kingdom period, the saints get to be the ones who are in charge.
It still doesn't make sense because God is the judge, and only God will judge the people. They can't come back and have anything to do with it because they're going to be there with them. It doesn't make sense.
And it's something like they want to punish somebody. I mean, here we are, we get to rule over you, good over evil.
In which place they wouldn't be in heaven anyway, would they?
Well, not
if they're evil.
Yeah, they're going to be on earth, and it's appealing to say that the Christians finally get to be in charge.
But they're not supposed to be in charge.
Well, but that's what they argue, and and you can see that that's appealing. I mean, there have been times in my life when I thought the world is so wicked that I was just going to pick up my family. I was going to go buy some little island somewhere where we could live and we could be sufficient on that little bitty island. And I was not going to build a bridge. I was not going to build a dock so I could get my family onto the island. Then I was going to blow up the dock so nobody else could come.
But then you can't enjoy a real Christian life because you don't love your brother enough to be with him. So that's contradictory.
I know.
But I know what you mean. have certain things that we have to do also.
I know. And fortunately, I married a good woman who wouldn't let me do that.
I'm glad. Very glad. Well, I know, but I don't see how they can really consider themselves a Christian and come back with Jesus, because it's his kingdom. It's not ours. We have nothing to do with it until the end of time. And then he'll turn his reign back to God, and then we'll all be together as one in heaven.
Right.
But I guess they don't really take any of that into consideration, because they probably haven't studied it enough to know, as you said before. They just don't have enough knowledge. In other words, they're believing whatever they want to believe because it makes them feel good.
Yes, and I have friends that believe all that, and they read their Bible faithfully. And I've tried to get them to see it doesn't make one iota of sense. And they just say no. That's what it is.
So.
Yes, somebody had a comment.
Yes, when Jesus comes down and takes all the saints up to him to paradise, not to heaven, aren't we transformed into a spirit like God? Don't they have the transformation there? I mean, that's what it talks about. Or do they think that they're just living in a body up there in paradise?
I don't know the answer to that, Carol, but it's a good point.
That's because they've never read it, and they don't know that. Because they believe what somebody else tells them, and they don't research it. And so they've probably never even thought about that, because they didn't read their Bible.
Well, I'll tell you, it would be a lot easier to understand biblical information. This is just my thought. If everything was arranged in chronological order. But it's not. You get it, especially in the Old Testament, covers such a long period of time that, and you bounce around. This prophet talked about this period of time, and this prophet who comes later in the Bible talked about a period of time that was before the other guy. So it's confusing. And I think that if we could get people to read it in chronological order, they would see, okay, God made a promise, I'm going to bring you back. And then he kept the promise. And you don't need to be looking for it to be fulfilled in the future, because it's already been fulfilled. But it's hard to get that out of the Old Testament because of its organization. I kind of feel like a chronological organization is better, because that's the way we're used to reading things.
When I'm reading it, I know that this has already happened, because Isaiah prophesied it. Now Ezekiel's doing it, and the next one will do it, and he'll go way back again and come back around.
Yeah.
But when I read the one, I can compare the two, and I go, oh, that's the same thing. So
yeah,
I've been studying a lot, as you can tell. I wanted to see how this worked because of Revelation, I guess, mainly. And I just get behind on my thinking, because you have to read it all the time. You can't just read it once or twice and then forget about it. You have to put all that together. It is a little hard, but if you just had one prophet, you probably wouldn't believe that either.
it's kind of like watching Star Wars when you read the Old Testament.
Yes. You know,
Star Wars number one, then number two, then number three happened before number one. And you get prequels and sequels, and I have a hard time figuring out who came first, the chicken or the egg. You know, it's confusing information. And I don't think God gave us that to confuse us.
No, but he gave us good preachers and good teachers to show us.
Well, I think we sometimes teachers.
If we didn't have people like you teaching us.
Well, thank you, but sometimes
get confused too.
You know, it was somebody's idea to put all of the prophets in this together.
Yeah.
And I kind of, I wish that they had interspersed them where they belong in First and Second Chronicles and First and Second Kings.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. And, you know, it just makes it hard to read.
Well, you could leave the Old Testament out and have the New Testament. You won't know as much of the history as you do if you studied it, because it brings us to Christ. But you could be saved by reading the New Testament and just take what it says. If you didn't know it, but we do need the Old Testament, definitely, because it proves everything else that came before Christ. So,
right. And you see so many references in the New Testament to things in the Old Testament. If you didn't have the Old Testament, you wouldn't know who Abraham was.
That's true. So, very true.
You know, we need Abraham. We need David. And if you didn't have those things, you wouldn't have it.
That's true. So I have to say, ah, duh. <'Cause> that's true.
But you know, I have to tell you that I'm as guilty as everybody else. I tend to read the New Testament, and I don't read the Old Testament as much as I should. And it's really embarrassing when you can get somebody to look in the Old Testament for a book that isn't there.
Yeah.
And that's almost as bad as when you go through the Old Testament and you have to kind of break the edges of the pages because they're still stuck together the way they came from the printer.
Mine's so old, it's not every page is stuck.
Well, I have a Bible that I've owned since 1970, and the dirty pages start at Matthew.
Yeah. Mine are probably worn more there because we tend to do that. But I have a study Bible, and so it tells me where to look in each book to find that reference. You go to Deuteronomy, or you go to here, you go to there, and in the Old Testament, it's the same thing. It'll turn you back to Matthew, because that's what was the law. And then but it takes study. You can't just read it, really.
That's true. And I must say, that's what I think is going to be the best thing that comes out of Lenny's class.
Yes.
We'll become more familiar with just the story of the Bible. Think about how hard it is for somebody to just sit down and read the New Testament without any kind of idea about the Old Testament. And they read about Abraham and they go, who on earth is Abraham? I haven't read about him yet. So Lenny's class is going to do a lot for us to keep us thinking about the entirety of the Bible. Well, I want to thank you guys for bearing with me. I know that I sometimes get really long-winded. Like Kim said, I know how to write. I know how to write academic papers, and I don't write the kinds of things that are easy to read. So thank you for bearing with me and sticking in there. I told you we'd get to these theories, but we had to do all the front work before we could talk about these theories.
Speaking of that thing, I see Armageddon on there. that's a big, big thing in itself.
Right.
It's not what we think it is if you just read the word and you don't know anything about it.
Right. Right. That's the typical mistake. Jesus' kingdom is not of this world. If it was his kingdom, his servants would fight. And people want the fight to happen at Armageddon. And it's a mistake.
Well, I noticed an interesting thing the other day when I was reading, because it talks about dead bones and bones are there and God adds sinew to them. And that, but it was to prove a point. It wasn't real men. He was saying he was going to put the life back into Jerusalem, Israel. And they, it wasn't, there was one with the dead bones coming alive and marching around, but this one wasn't it.
Yeah, that's, you're absolutely right. And if you just know that Ezekiel prophesied among the Jewish exiles in Babylon, that'll do a lot to explain Ezekiel's Valley of Dry Bones and how they come together again. And that is Israel returning. And they did return.
Yeah.
They did possess the land again, but it was always conditional. God said, I'll give you this land, but if you disobey me, I will not give you this land in perpetuity. I will give it to you if you obey me. And they didn't.
It's the same thing in the New Testament. If you don't obey God's will, then you're not going to be saved.
That's right.
There's no way. He won't accept you.
That's right.
Anyway, I think you did a good job.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jimmy.
And I liked everybody's comments. Carol gets me laughing, though.
Yeah. Yep, tomorrow night we're going to continue with Alexander Campbell, and we're going to talk about what he did when he came and finally joined his father.
That's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Yep.